You're now listening to Sleep Time Sober.
Before we get Flash on, which is going to be a good fun one, I wanted to talk about what's been happening lately with, I guess we've been having the surge in the COVID cases, right? And the numbers are all going up and everybody's worried about stuff and closing and are we shutting down again and whatnot. So I just want to make a plea out there to everyone who has been going out, not to restaurants, but I want to address the people going out to house parties. I want to address the people going to other people's homes, hanging out, having a party situation in that sense. I want to reach out to all of you to please use good judgment. Please be responsible. And I know it's at a house party. There's no rules of any social distancing, whatever going on. That is a big factor, I think, in why these cases are rising. I think we're using the restaurants, bars, even gyms as a type of scapegoat here. Shutting down the businesses again is not the answer. Looking at responsibility and responsibility of everyone in gatherings, looking at responsible people just going to house parties. We have to look at that. We've had Father's Day. We've had grad parties. We're going to have 4th of July numbers coming really soon. That is what I would like all of you to just please be safe out there. Please be responsible when going to somebody else's house to hang out in these gatherings. It's the gathering situation that is, I feel, a factor in these cases rising. Cases were going to rise regardless when things are opening up. That's understandable. But let's look at being responsible people when going out and going into a party, a house party of 10, a house party of 20, and no one's doing anything of any regulations whatsoever. Just please keep that in mind, that that is also a serious situation. So please, that's why I'm wearing the shirt of Save Hawaii's Businesses. I think it's a huge scapegoat to draw local businesses, restaurants, bars, gyms to be the culprit here. We need to look at that. Flash is on here. And shout out AlohaMask.com. Everyone should be wearing a mask. Everyone should be doing the social distancing thing. I know we're sick and tired of saying the word social distancing. Ige can't even say it clearly, but I'm just saying to all of you, weekend's coming up. Do we really need to go to a house party? Do we need to go to somebody's house and gather around for 20, 30 people? That's all I'm saying. RJ, I gotta meet up with you. So let's shift gears here, because this is a man that I always wanted to have on the show. I wanted to talk in person with, because this man has had so much history. This man is, to me, an iconic, not only in just Honolulu, but of the state of Hawaii through the years. Sorry, I'm not trying to make you sound old, Flash. But he is an icon, events promoter, nightclub promoter, marketing director for BAMP Project. I mean, we look on the Republic marketing director, radio show host on 101.9, co-owner of Modern Media, marketing director, marketing master, extraordinaire. I think you do weddings too, right, Flash? We'll talk about that. Skyline, if you guys remember that, Skyline of Honolulu. I was there, Flash, I know. And we can't forget the infamous Wave Waikiki, which we're going to go have some fun with. I've always wanted to talk to this man, and I have a little story to share with him of my first encounter with him back in 1997. Let's bring him on in, Flash Hansen. Flash Hansen, finally. Let's bring him on in here, as they say. Here we are. Where is this man? This icon. There he is.
Hey. How you doing?
Finally.
I don't know if my lighting too bright?
Oh. I think you're good. You look good in any light.
I'm glad you didn't have me join yet until after you introduced me, because it was pretty embarrassing.
I have to do it because I feel people need to know. People need to know that you have extended history, which it sounds weird me saying this because it's like making you feel old.
I am old. I have no problem telling you I'm 48. I used to hide it because, promoters, they want to pretend like they're young all the time. But
right.
Now I wear it as a badge of honor. You know, I've been doing parties and events even before the wave. I've been doing this since 96, yeah. One way or the other. All Unreal. Different ways and in facets of putting on events. I've done all of it.
Yes, you have. And I have to share with you this. Okay, so I want to start with this story. You talk about 96. Back in 1997, I you're not going to remember this, but I was trying to start an AM hip-hop mix show on KZU Radio, the Japanese AM station. So I go in there and I pitch this idea to them, and they said it's good to go, but I need to get sponsors. So then I knew a person by the name of DMFD.
D motherfucking D. Can I swear on your show? I'm sorry. Sorry, I don't know the rules on your podcast.
Right. And he would go and sell records, right? He obviously would have Black Fiend and whatnot. So I would go and talk to him, and I would be like, hey, who do I get to sponsor? And then I would go, and he mentioned, why don't you go talk to Flash? Why don't you talk to Wave Waikiki? And I'm like, okay, how do we do that? Why don't you fax him something? To show the
day. Now we're all showing our age.
So I'm like, oh, how do I do that? So then I faxed the Wave, and I didn't know what, I just put the proposal of what it was. And you called me back, and you were like, you left me a message. Hey, this is Flash. Yeah, I'd like to sponsor the show. And I'm like, I was just like flipping out. I was like, wow, who is this guy? This guy is like on board. He doesn't know who the hell I am. And I guess long story short, it didn't go through because I just didn't have enough sponsors to put this show together. So I ended up scrapping it, but that was in 1997. Wow. And I always remember that. I was like, here's this guy. I have no idea who you are. You have no idea who I am. And you were just instantly being like, oh, we'll sponsor this AM hip hop show. I'm like, so I'm telling you.
Yeah.
You
know, back in those days, I was, I mean, obviously you wouldn't know it by looking at me, but I was, I at that time I wouldn't use these types of words because I didn't even understand, you know, the world in the way I do now. But I was a huge proponent and a huge sponsor of hip hop in general, of I almost want to say underground.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah. Right on there.
Proponent of, and so I thought it was important. What's up, Drama? Drama just joining us.
Drama's on here. There we go.
I always thought it was important to support and promote and sort of nurture and foster the local, not just the hip hop scene, but the local music scene. But I feel like at that time, it was just the timing of it was the local hip hop scene is what needed the most nurturing. You know, it was the squeakiest wheel. So I was always just ready to jump in and do what I could. And it was one of my big things at the Wave. The Wave played zero hip hop before I got there. And it was super obvious to me to bring hip hop to the Wave. And, it was really important to foster that local scene. Anyway,
yeah,
I'll let you continue. By the way, I'm having a cocktail. Do you have cocktails on your show? I drink on my podcast. So I figured
we're drinking hourly here. So yes, all right, but I just have coffee right now. So I'm sorry. I'll just join with you. 1739 was around that time
before,
as well.
Yeah, before. 1739 was 94 to 96. And that was a nightclub I opened when I was 24 years old with three other people. And of the four of us, none of us knew what the hell we were doing. At that point, I had only been bartending. So I was like the bar manager. I didn't do anything with the entertainment, nothing with the promotions, like all the stuff that people know me for now. No, at that point I was the bar guy. I was the bar manager and I was the head bartender. I ran the cocktail program. I was responsible for the cocktail program and training the bar staff. And that's all I knew and cared about. I didn't know a Sub-Zero from a Daniel J to Latin. I didn't know any of that stuff.
Right.
And that was 1739 was really my introduction to that whole world. Cause before that I had been bartending in clubs, but they were mainstream clubs. You know, like Blue Zebra. Where I met Peter B and Daniel J actually at Blue Zebra, right. But I was just a bartender making money and I was a free agent. I just wanted to go to the busiest places. I didn't really care where, right. I was just there to make money. And so I didn't know anything about local nightlife culture, even though I was working in clubs. I didn't realize there was this whole scene separate from the Restaurant Rose and Aloha Towers of the world. And, so it was four of us opened 1739. We were open for almost 2 years. We were the first club in Hawaii to play hip hop 7 days a week, which was crazy. And, you know, people were, you know, I hate to say it, a lot more racist back then than they are now. And like, oh, black people and black music, like there's going to be fights. And like, I don't want this crowd. It's too dark in here and all that. And we were just like, the music is amazing. Like, you know, the mid 90s. I mean, that was like the golden era of hip hop. So we were, that's what really put 1739 on the map, was the fact that we were playing hip hop 7 days a week, and we were playing like the real hip hop. I mean, that's sort of where Stone Groove got there. You know, any given night, you're going to see Sub, you're going to see Drama, you're going to see G-Dog, you're going to see Gary O, you're going to see like the all Gary guys in one spot. It was, and again, at the time, I didn't know that, because that was all new to me. All I cared about is like, oh, what kind of vodka do we have and stuff like that. Right. But yeah, it was a great spot. And then in the main, the hip hop room was like the lounge, and then the main room played house music.
Right.
No EDM kids back in those days. It was real house music. And
yeah,
that's where Daniel J had his Friday residency, and he was, you know, pop about four pills of ecstasy and spin like a 10-hour set and just murder it. You just kill it. Like all those guys, we had the best DJs in Hawaii. I thought hands down, no one else could come close as far as our full roster went. And I was very, very fortunate. And that was really my, it was very eye opening for me. And that was sort of my entree into this underworld nightlife scene that was different than, again, like, you know, bartending at all the different places that I had bartended at before that, which were a lot more mainstream. But I just went where the money was, so.
Right. And then from there, we got I don't want to forget, the Pussycat Lounge at Wave.
Yeah, so the Pussycat Lounge started after 1739 closed. I have a funny story about G-Dog, too, about Pussycat
here
Lounge,
we go.
Just to start it off. But 1739 was open for almost 2 years, and we closed in 96. And it was, you know, we were a bunch of kids. No one was making money. When we weren't even... You don't even think about money in those days, other than we got to pay the bills. You were just having fun. And in 96, we shut down, and we knew we had something special, and we had sort of created this culture and these people. And it definitely just wasn't, it was the whole, the staff, the customers, we were all just one big family, and everyone knew that like we were doing this thing that no one else knew about. And it was our sort of little secret society, but it was really, really cool. And everyone was just friends. Like so many people that I met back in those days that I'm still friends with, and they were just like customers, you know, like, and it was just this really cool scene. And we wanted it to continue. We didn't have, there was definitely no business forethought to it at all, but we just thought, we're closed. Where can we go and take this thing? This is so great. This is so special. Like, we just want to keep this going. We wanted, as much as anything, to give our entertainers a place to show, like a showcase for them. And we most importantly wanted to give our customers a place to keep that sense of community and family going. It was super important to us. And I couldn't even tell you why I thought it was important. I just knew that it was. Yeah. It was really, it really was like a family. Like, I just wanted these people to like stay together. So, we thought it was, where could we take this? What do we do? And this was pretty pre-promoter. There was maybe Daniel J and G-Spot were the only two promoters doing events. So nightlife promoter wasn't even really quite a thing yet. Especially on a weekly basis, G-Spot and Daniel were throwing raves, and that's periodically, once a month, once a quarter. They were really more sporadic back in those days. So no one was doing like weekly events. So just to even think about that was different. And again, I didn't know this at the time, but we knew that we looked at the landscape of nightlife in Hawaii, and there was only one nightclub that we even wanted to do it at, and it was the Wave or nothing. So we went to the Wave, and we didn't know anybody there. I'd been there a few times, you know, after 1739, I'd go maybe once a week, but you know, we were open till 8 a.m. So I wasn't going to the Wave that often, because we were doing crazy after hours. I'd gone there enough to know that this was the spot. But I didn't know the GM. I didn't know any of the managers. I certainly didn't know the owner. We knew who the owner was. Jack Law is like nightlife legend. You hear the name, but
I don't even,
Yeah, I don't even know how we just were like, I don't know, like it wasn't this, but it was the whatever version of like, let's just pick up the yellow pages and like make a call on a rotary dial phone. And somehow like we got in touch with their marketing director and pitched him on this night. And he's like, well, you can have Tuesdays. They're our slowest night. Like it's the only night that's available. And we can't do anything with that night. Like that night is just a bust. And they're open 7 days a week. So if they have, you know, the weekends are busy, these other weeknights are decent, like whatever. We're like, oh my God, they said yes. So we were just like beyond thrilled. And it was a classic, you know, door bar split. There was no bar percentages back then, certainly no bottle service cut, anything like that. Right. It's like 100% of the expenses on you, whatever you charge, whatever you want at the door and whatever, but it's all on you. You know, they provide us with a resident DJ, and that's when I met KSM and had my mind blown. So other than the resident DJ and the security, which was great that they paid for that, and I mean they had it in house, we had to you know, provide everything. So
Flash is shutting us down. What happened? Somebody did not like the Pussycat Lounge talk. You're freezing. Okay, you're back. Okay.
I had my alarm on snooze. So
we just
took everything that was 1739 and we put it into one night. So that was the first time the wave we're like, can we put a DJ booth upstairs? It's really important. Like we have to have that because we wanted a hip hop room and a house room just like 1739 had. And they were like, oh, we're like hip hop and like, that's weird. And like, we're like a rock dirty club. And we're just like, no, it has to be this.
Right.
So we set up a DJ upstairs and we actually had like Quadrophonics would play early and you know, all those kinds of, there were such great bands back then. Spun was another one. Quadrophonics was obviously the big one. But we would do the like, you know, funky, cool live music early. And then we would be house music downstairs. And then hip hop upstairs. And the very first night, we obviously didn't know what the hell we were doing. And G-Dog, the very first night, blows the speakers and blows an amp. The very first night. And again, we don't know what the hell we're doing. I don't think we'd signed a contract that covered, you know.
Not at all.
Destruction of property and all that sort of stuff. And my knowledge at that time was very limited on things. I mean, in hindsight, it's like, why didn't you have limiters on everything? I don't know. But anyway, we blew an amp.
Yeah.
So the first night we're done and like, they're just like, you blew this amp, this $800 amp. This is $1996, mind you. You blew an $800 amp, you blew speakers. And you know, Grant's just like, whoa, you know, just I'm so fire that I'm you know, blowing up speakers and stuff. And we were freaking out. We're like, I don't want to say we didn't care about the money, but like we at least made enough money where we could have paid for that. But we just thought they're going to like, we're just a bunch of dumb kids. We're not professional. Clearly, we're not professional. We don't know what the hell we're doing. We're going to lose this after the first night. But, you know, in hindsight, the night was busy. Like everything about the night other than the blown amp was good. But we were freaking out. And I was so like, I don't want to say I was mad at Grant, but like I was just like, Grant was like the old man back then. And he knew more about any of this stuff than any of the rest of us did. And it's like, you should know better. Like you should be the one coming up to me saying, dude, Sub-Zero is in the red. Like you got to turn it down.
Right.
Or you're going to blow the equipment and they're going to like fire you guys. No, he's the guy blowing the equipment.
Thanks, man.
Anyway, so that obviously ended up not being a problem. And then the Pussycat Lounge ran for over 8 years. At the time, it was like the longest running weekly nightlife thing ever. And even when we were doing it and even when it was successful, like the first couple months, it wasn't like a thing. Like we were just like biding our time to figure out what our next move was going to be as individuals. And also again, we just wanted to keep the 1739 thing going. And then it just kept getting busier and busier and busier. And it's like, even at $5 cover, it's like, oh, this money's kind of real. And,
so. Iconic spot. And, just amazing how on a Tuesday night, like people don't realize, I think anybody realizes that's you young guys out there watching this, it was Tuesday night. Like, can that even possibly happen in 20? Well, there's a lot of stuff that might not be able to possibly happen in 2020, but a Tuesday night event is just insane.
You know, having said that, sure, you can give me props, but let's be realistic. Back then, there was every night you could go somewhere. It wasn't just us on Tuesdays. Ocean Club had their thing on Tuesdays.
Shipley's Wednesday.
Shipley's on Wednesday. You know, Brew Moon on Sunday.
Yeah.
Tuesday ended up being the big night in town, oddly, because it was Pipeline had dollar drinks, Pussycat Lounge, and then the Ocean Club thing. And those were three different crowds, so it worked.
Gotcha.
But there was enough people going out back in those days on weeknights to have three places be totally packed. But every night of the week except Mondays back then, there was at least one spot that you knew was going to be packed. And you know, we were just happy to ride that wave. No pun intended.
Yeah, it was an amazing time, iconic time. I guess what did that lead to other types of, as you were doing Pussycat Lounge, as 1739, and all this? What led to your next endeavors? What were you thinking and brewing as a Pussycat Lounge is going on?
I you're going to be so disappointed. I have had very little forethought in everything I did in my 20s and my 30s. It was all just happenstance. You know, I opened the nightclub because, you know, Don and Jason and Kim approached me. I was the last piece of the puzzle. They were going to do it with or without me, but they were like, do you want to open a nightclub? Okay, sure. Then it's like, oh, the Wave just offers you this job to be their promotions and marketing director. Okay. At some point along the way, I ended up being at the Wave for 8 years, and the Wave is fantastic. It's great. It's like, I describe it to people that don't know it. It's like, it was the Studio 54 of Hawaii, like hands down. Totally. It was open from 1980 to 2006, had an amazing run, and it was the spot.
Yeah.
There's a million different celebrities there, and we can talk about, you know, all the celebrities and all the crazy, crazy stuff that I saw
there. We're getting to that.
And the Wave was this very, you couldn't do it today with social media and all that. But the Wave was, when you walk through the doors of the Wave, you could do anything, eight balls and hookers and this and whatever. It was, it was no holds barred. It was wild. And, but at some point along there, you know, I got comfortable of, okay, like, I know what I'm doing now. And like, I know that I can pretty much throw a decent event like all the time. And so after a while, it's not as challenging anymore, number one. And then number two, I was starting to see things that, ideas that I would have that I'm like, well, this doesn't work at the Wave. You know, I could walk into the Wave in shorts and slippers and a tank top and on a Saturday night and be there till 4 in the morning. And that's fine. You know, I was like, you know, what if I want to like dress up and go on like a real date, but like not a restaurant and not a movie? You know, what about this idea that I have for this other thing that's just, it's not the right fit here? And you know, anybody in the business knows it's like, it's not just the right idea in any venue. It has to be the right idea and the right venue for it to work.
Exactly.
I mean, that's just two of the factors and why it needs to work. But There does have to be that perfect harmony between the venue, the physical space, the venue itself, and whatever the event is. And I was constantly, you know, I'm having to come up with ideas all the time, and not all of them are going to fit for the Wave, but it doesn't mean it's a bad idea.
Right.
And so I started, at this point, Matty Boy was my, started working for me. And that was sort of the game changer for me in that, I was so busy at the Wave working 60 plus hours a week and, you know, being there till 4 in the morning and then being back at work at 9 or 10 the next day. And that's a grind. And it was like, I couldn't do all this stuff on my own. And once I brought Matty Boy on board, he wasn't even my assistant at first. He was like a little grom that just did whatever I needed him to do for $7 an hour. But, Matty Boy and I started having a good relationship, and we just worked really well together. And, you know, we did some, I took some of his ideas for the Wave, and I just liked who he was and how his brain worked and everything. Yeah. And he made me really question stuff in a way of, you know, it's like, well, why do you do it this way? And he was so completely outside the club world is he didn't have any preconceived notions about anything. And right. he was very curious. So he would ask you, right. well, why is it that way? And it would challenge yeah. me because then I'm like, yeah, fuck, why is it that way? Why don't we do yeah. it this way? Like, there is no rules. It's parties. And exactly. so we did some events together at the Wave, actually starting at Pussycat Lounge. I did a monthly theme night with him called Glitter and Glamour. And yes. it worked really well. And we were like, you know what? Like we have these ideas and, you know, he was in the same boat about what about, you know, doing stuff at other places. So I don't know when, maybe about halfway through my time at the Wave, we started reaching out and doing stuff around town. And I had done stuff before too. I partnered up with the Vertical Junkies with, you know, Russ and Blaine, Mikey. And God, who am I forgetting? But yeah, those guys. Oh, Kanoi. Kanoi's the other one. God bless those guys. So I had been doing sporadic events because, and I just, promoters, I wasn't going to promoters. Promoters were coming to me saying, do you want to partner up on this and that? It's outside the Wave. And I did it because it's just something different. And I knew that all these parties would end at 2:00 and then I could just push everyone to the Wave. So like I could actually make the Wave busier because these people weren't going to come to the Wave before 2:00 anyway. Exactly. So I might as well capture them, control them, and push them to the Wave instead of somewhere else. And obviously making the extra money doesn't hurt either. So I had done sporadic stuff, but it wasn't anything consistent. And it wasn't like I was trying to do all this other stuff. But once Maddie came on board and him and I started working together, well, we started doing it like consistently and we started being quite successful at it. And then it was like, oh, okay. Like, you know, this side thing is growing, getting more and more and more. And then it got to a point where, I definitely wanted to leave the Wave probably 2 years before I did, but I felt a very strong loyalty to Jack, and to the staff and to, everybody there to just sort of keep doing it, even though at that point I was making more money and having more success outside the Wave. But I don't want to say I overstayed my welcome, but I definitely thought I personally should have left a couple years before I did. If I was purely objective about everything, but I just wanted to stay because I wanted to help him out. And I just, you know, I wanted to, and I also didn't want the Wave to fall apart after I left. That's not an ego thing. I just knew it's just like a very, very hard, unforgiving job. It just, you have to, it's like, it has to be your life or it's not going to work.
Yeah. Unreal stuff. I mean, I guess you give us a timetable here of, I guess maybe we'll go for like mid 2000s because I know you did Skyline. There was Hana Hana Room.
So I left the Wave in 2005, about a year before they closed.
Okay.
And that was part of my decision too. It wasn't public knowledge, but I knew the Wave was on the clock. So and that helped it make it okay for me to leave. Started up me Como Low. Me, Como, and Maddie started Skyline together, and Como was, I think, how people looked at Maddie and I further down the road. That Como was already that, like, 3 years before us. He was doing very interesting stuff. Como was really sort of ahead of the curve, and he just always had a really strong vision of what he wanted to do and how he wanted to go about it. And Como and I had been doing events before Maddie Boy as well. And, you know, Como and I would do events and we'd have Maddie run the door and all that stuff. And I just slowly but surely was sort of, you know, taking Maddie under my wing and growing him up. But Como ended up being my main partner for events before Maddie Boy came on. And Skyline at the Hana Hana Room, Como brought that to me and he said, you know, let's do this. And I said, I will only do it if Maddie Boy can be an equal partner. And Como was actually reluctant to do it. I don't think for any other reason that, you know, promoters, they do love their cash. And, you know, the split three ways isn't as much as, you know, you don't put as much in your pocket as if it's split two ways. And Como knew, and I did too. It would have been successful if it was just the two of us, but that wasn't as important to me as having Maddie be a part of it. And I never really did any events for the sake of the dollar. And that's probably why, ironically, I ended up being successful is if you're doing stuff for the money, you end up paying attention to the wrong things.
Right.
It ended up being, that was in 2005, maybe 2004, 2004, 2005.
Okay, right.
But I know that there was at least a year, if not longer, turnover, because the Skyline would end at 2, and then we would push everybody over, and it was like Skyline got crazy successful, and you know we're pushing over like a couple hundred people every night that we did it, and so there was a nice little overlap for maybe a year and a half or 2 years there, but it was 2004-05, and then that ran for about 5 years too.
Right, Skyline. That's another iconic one. Skyline Honolulu Room. The location alone is the great draw. Everybody dressed up. You got the one guy cutting t-shirts, and you had the
Adam
one guy
Sachs.
Playing the bongos.
Yeah.
You had G Spot over there. I mean, you had all kind of stuff going on. You probably had cocaine over there. I don't know. It was everywhere.
Yeah.
All kind of entertainment going on. It was just that was a scene. That the club scene in the early 2000s, mid 2000s is just amazing. And,
And you had it wasn't just us. Like I said, Como, there was a bunch of the Vertical Junkies. There was a bunch of guys that were really passionate about throwing good events, and the money was secondary. And so you could go out on any given night and have your choice of 3 or 4 or 5 banging spots.
Yeah.
And that's totally separate from all the cool underground stuff that was going on. It was a very, very fun time. But, there wasn't things were different. There wasn't a pint and jigger or a leather apron to go to back then.
Yeah.
So it was like, you had to create the scene yourself. And and there was a bunch of people that were really good at it doing their thing.
Right. You had you go down the line, Architects and all those guys. You could go down to Kaizo Speed Gear. You had Jamal, who did his thing as far as underground. You had Downtown with Havana Cabana.
Yeah.
So much things
going
on. Well, I guess I got to ask you this, though.
And Stone Groove was just doing their thing the whole time, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look at that. They had a control in the week. They had a we got to go Hard Rock Cafe. Do you remember the event? $5 pitchers and rubber slippers. Do you remember this?
Drama. Alika. I remember when $5 pitcher and rubber slippers was at Liquid Surf Den before it was at the Hard Rock.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember the radio ad. Whoever did that was great.
It was always Alika.
That was him doing it.
Alika would go in and he wouldn't have a script. And it was like him and the VJ boys or whatever. They would just wing it. Yeah, but that $5 pitcher and rubber slippers, I mean, that is
great.
One of the most iconic marketing taglines ever.
I still remember that. I love it.
And
I would love to hear it again.
Alika also came up with $2 drinks. What? $2 drinks. What? That was him. Oh, I love that guy.
Wow. See how fun it is, people. Back then,
it was very fun. It was a bunch of young kids that just wanted to have fun and put on a good show because we wanted to have a good time and we wanted you to have a good time. It really was just super fun.
Exactly. I guess we'll transition from let's go look into the late 2000s, 2010s. How did your career transition from there, from the Skyline to next?
So towards the end of Skyline, I'm trying to, I get confused on the days. At some point we were doing Skyline and then we were also ended up doing every Friday night at Pearl.
Wow, Pearl, yes.
And this was, Pearl hadn't been open maybe a year or two. And they were, for whatever reason, they would bump on Saturdays, but their Fridays were not great. And just in general, Saturdays around town were busier than Fridays. And so they wanted us to come in and help them out. And so we were doing Fridays at Pearl, and this is just Maddie Boy and I were doing, we started doing Fridays at Pearl and then we were doing Skyline. And at this time we were doing the Sheraton Kauai every Friday. We'd send a whole team to Poipu every Friday. I think we were doing like Thursday monthlies with Honolulu Magazine. Like we were doing a lot of stuff and it was busy. We were doing once a month on the off Skyline Saturdays. We were doing Harbor Court Saturdays and that was busy. But it got to a point, especially with Matty Boy, where he was just like over it. You know, we're going out. We would have our own 3 or 4 events a week. And then the other, whatever nights you're off, you're going out. You're slinging flyers. You're handing out business cards. Let me put your number in the phone. You're flirting with the girl to get her to come. She thinks you like her, but really, I just want you to come to the party.
Let's show up, right?
And, you know, you would have to go out, but it was worth going out because it was busy everywhere and at all the different spots. And that's, you know, again, this is pre really pre-social media, you know, maybe the beginning of email blast and maybe the beginning of text blast, but really it was, you had to pound the pavement, you had to earn it. You know, let's fly the cars in Chinatown and all that stuff. So we were out every night.
Yeah.
And even when it's fun and even when you're making money, like after a while, and you still got to do all the daytime stuff to make it all, to tee it all up.
Right, of course.
And after a while, it just, especially Maddie was just over it. He was never like that sort of guy to begin with anyway. And he was happy to hang in the background while I was sort of like the front guy. But he just finally was like, I'm just not into this anymore. And this was like 06, 07, 08. And okay. we knew we could tell a recession was coming. Things Skyline was packed. We were capacity every single Skyline for like 4 years straight and sold out on bottles. I mean, we maximized the amount of revenue we could get out of that space, and we were doing okay. But we knew, looking into the future, and this is when you start to get a little older and you do treat it a little bit more like a business. We knew that, like any event does, it has a finite lifespan. And okay, after this, I don't see us being able to do recreating Skyline with that revenue and with that excitement and that price point. And so we were starting to think about, and we're getting older. It's like, do I want to be up till, you know, out till 4 a.m. and, you know, drinking 20 freaking shots all night.
Right.
It's a hard life. You know, it's hard to be a successful promoter.
Yeah.
And so him before I, but both of us were like, okay, what's our next move here? We knew Skyline was peaking, but we knew it wasn't going to last forever. We knew that there was a slowdown on the horizon. You could feel the trend of things in town, just the vibe, everything was sort of in this weird, okay, we're in a transitional phase, but no one knows what the next thing is. And you know, for better or worse, the recession sort of decided what it was for everybody, but we knew that was all coming. We had an idea for this restaurant concept for quite some time. And that was essentially what in a nutshell, the concept was, instead of us coming into a restaurant like Hanohano and having to bring the sound, to bring the lights, to bring all the infrastructure, what if all that stuff was just built into the restaurant to begin with, and we ran the restaurant? And then so instead of Han, it was this partnership between us and Hano. And of course, it's like, you're like, oh, I wish Hano did this, or I wish, you know, their normal crowd wasn't so stuffy and the price point of the food wasn't so high. And imagine if there was more of a synergy between the restaurant and the nightlife side, that'd be really cool. And it's like, man, if we actually had a restaurant, then the restaurant would stand on its own, and you don't have to be at the bar doing shots with everyone that walks through the door. No, people aren't disappointed or won't come if you're not there, because they'll come because it's a restaurant and the food's good and you know, whatever, all that stuff. So we thought it was a logical sort of baby step in a different direction. And that's when we had the idea for a year or two, and it really had sort of a pretty good concept in our head. And then we sort of lucked ass backwards into apartment 3.
Yeah.
And so we thought that was going to be, oh, we're so smart, you know, we're gonna like have a restaurant, and then all that stuff I just said, all the pros of that. And then of course the recession hit, and we opened a restaurant literally the summer that the recession hit. And you know, restaurants in the best of times have shitty margins, are just unbelievably hard to operate. And again, just like the nightclub, we didn't know what we were doing, but you just say yes. Like you don't think about reasons not to do it. You just are like, let's just do it, and we'll figure it out as we go. And apartment 3 was open for 3 years, but that was sort of our step into, we don't want to throw parties anymore. We'll throw events at Skyline, but like, or at Skyline, at apartment 3, but we wanted it to be to where it wasn't the promoters, the venue itself was the selling point, the chef, the food, the cocktail program. So it didn't matter if we were there or not, so that we could sort of have, like, God forbid, like a life outside of work. And you know, at that point, like, Maddie's getting, you know, settling down, he's getting a wife and all the stuff, and you know, BAMP at this point is is becoming more of a thing. You know, at this point, BAMP started in 04. So when we opened the restaurant in 09, BAMP is 5 years in, and BAMP was definitely a thing. And it's somewhere in the beginning of Apartment 3, I end up doing the morning radio show with Maleko. So there's other stuff going on, and there's more adult stuff going on. And so Apartment 3 was, that was from 09 to 2012. And that was our baby step out of the whole thing.
Right. I mean, you can see the timeline of how age plays a factor. We live and learn, and we evolve, and we
you see this?
To, yeah. Look at that. You should be drinking. I'm telling you, I should start drinking at this point.
I drink it every podcast Maleko and I do. We typically have a bartender, but obviously I can't have a bartender in the studio right now. So that we just make our home cocktails. Huh?
Flash, I do my show at a bar.
I know. You finally get me on the show, and it's over Instagram Live instead of the speakeasy.
Yeah, and then pandemic.
We're going to need a part two no matter what.
There's a part two. I'm going to say for the record, I've always wanted to have you on for well over years from now. It's just, I don't know. It's just the timing or some bullshit. Timing.
Let me ask you this. So I have, there's a couple friends of mine that listen to your podcast. And they're every once in a while, they're like, you know, they mentioned your name and they said, you're going to come on the show. And I'm like, well, that's news to me. I'm like, that's the very first time I heard about the show is my one friend is like, are you going to be on this show? And I'm like, what are you talking about? What is this? What? And they're like, well, they said you were going to be on the show and they were talking about you. And I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
But anyway, but I appreciate that. I love the hustle. I love it.
It was a recurring joke. To be like the guy that I want to keep having on, but he's never here. And if anybody catches on, so somebody caught on and like, hey, are you going to come on the show?
Why don't you just reach out to me? It's not that hard.
That was the thing. It's timing. It was timing.
You send me a fax? Send me a fax.
Right? I've done that before. But yeah, I was going to build that thing up to be like, oh, next week Flash is going to be on. And the next month Flash is going to be on. And then build this thing up and then just have you to boom. But then we have viruses.
Now we're on Instagram Live. Yeah, I've definitely, you know, I've never been to that speakeasy upstairs, and I've always wanted to go. Yeah, never been.
We got,
I would definitely.
I'd love to have you there. You know this. Yes.
Definitely. I'm a huge fan of the alcohol.
I know. So, but yeah, so that'll be perfect. Hopefully, the word on the street is end of July. That's the word on the street. So
we'll see. Things are trending in the wrong direction, but fingers crossed.
Topic. Yeah. Well, let's get into what's going on currently. With things opening up, as far as now we have the District nightclub opening, with Strange Rules.
Blue Note. Shout out to the Element Group.
I think.
What are their rules? What are the rules there?
Okay. So no one can stand up, and there's no dancing. You all have to sit down. So they're making a long table. It's like the Last Supper. We're all just sitting down.
In fairness to them, the no dancing thing doesn't come from the district. That's coming from the city, right? They're saying you're not allowed to dance.
Yeah, that's a city. City ordinance. They're open.
I think that is silly because, well, a few things. Number one, just like anywhere else, you can socially distance on the dance floor if you want to. If you're coming from the same house, pod, whatever, and you're allowed to sit at the same table, then that table should be able to get up and dance and whatever, make little squares on the dance floor. And yeah, you're not going to be able to bump and grind up against the strange hot girl, but at least you can dance. But to say that we can sit at a table and hang out and talk story or go to a restaurant and eat together and maybe even eat from the same plate or all that stuff, and I can have the bartender hand me a drink or however it is they're serving drinks, but I can't get on the dance floor and dance. That's silly. And you know, and I know, there's definitely places in town where people are dancing right now and they don't give an F. It's happening.
You got that right.
And by the way, there's bars and there's I don't want to say clubs, but bars for sure that have been actual speakeasies. There's a lot of places that have not even been closed for one day during this whole thing. And if you know the right people and you got the right passcode and winky winky,
That's great you mentioned that, because yes, that is real. There are several.
It's super real. In fact, when this first started, you know, Maleko and I would joke on our show, who's going to open the first speakeasy? you know? And it was like, I think by the time we were saying that, people had already been doing it.
Yeah,
and, you know, if you're a business owner and you got to pay the bills.
Yeah. That's what you got to do. And you got Blue Note opening up. You got little concert venues opening up. Everyone's sitting down. When do we see something like a Republic opening up? When do we even fathomly see Blaisdell opening up?
So, obviously, you know, I've stayed very close to the BAMP boys. I was the marketing director for the Republic for the first 5 years after they opened, and BAMP Project, the concert company that owns the Republic. Matty Boys, he's still one of my best friends. We talk all the time. And they are, I don't know what I'm at liberty to say or not to say, other than they are definitely actively working on stuff. They're going to do some locals only stuff to start. They are, like everyone else, going to try to follow the rules. Nightclubs are weird. Like, is the Republic, there's different categories of venues. Are you a restaurant? Are you a bar?
Right.
Are you a nightclub? Are you a concert venue? You know, right. And if you're a place like a space like the Republic, where you could configure the space and do an event that can adhere to whatever the thing is. If the Republic wants to open and say they're doing a restaurant event, they can. We've right. done restaurant events there.
Right.
If you want to open and say that you're a bar, and that means you have different rules than if you are a concert venue or a large event space, is I think what they're calling it, then, and so they're stuck trying to figure out the lay of the land. In fact, I actually helped connect Maddie with the mayor's office the other day, because he's like, I'm reading this stuff and it's confusing. And that's someone that actually cares and it wants to pay attention. Now, most people are gonna read the thing and go, this makes no sense, I don't understand, I'm gonna ask for forgiveness. But the Republic is, you know, it's just how Maddie has always been, is he's going to do the right thing, or he's going to try to do the right thing as best he can. But I don't necessarily think it's through the city is definitely not doing it on purpose, but the city isn't helping anybody with the language that they're using and the ambiguity of things. And also not thinking about, you know, apartment three, is it a restaurant or is it a bar or is it a nightclub?
Right.
So there's things don't necessarily fit into one category nice and neat the way they want to categorize everything as far as gatherings and as far as protocols and capacity and all that.
Yeah.
So they're trying to figure that out. I would say at some point in August, they would be doing something. Now, what that something is, I don't know. It might just be, hey, we're going to open the bar, come hang out at the safe house. It might be Jenny Yim on her guitar.
Right.
Sitting wherever. I don't know. I don't know how it's going to look.
Yeah.
You know, I look at the news and I see all these people on the mainland trying different concerts, and inevitably it blows up in their face. And so what you don't want to do is do the thing and then get shut down, or do the thing and have the spotlight on you for you were trying to do everything right, but somehow you get nailed to the cross.
Right.
And then you're the asshole that does the thing. And then, you know, people are using your name as the example of what not to do.
Exactly.
But they are definitely doing their due diligence. They're definitely trying to figure it out. The Blaisdell is a little bit different because it's a city owned venue. So the Blaisdell is going to be as not a private entity, not a private business, but as they're all city employees.
Yeah.
And just like the Aloha Stadium, and I've talked to both of those venues, people at both of those venues that I work with regularly, they are completely at the mercy of the government on what to do and when to do it. You did see Aloha Stadium reopen the swap meet one day a week. I think it was Saturdays they opened, but not Wednesdays. They have been doing the food distribution things. And, you know, with the Rona on the rise the last couple of weeks, that's not helping anybody. You know, the mayor did come out earlier today and say anybody that doesn't adhere to these mandates, you're going to get one warning. And then the second time we're going to shut you down, which, by the way, I thought that was already the case as it were. I didn't know he needed to state that, but apparently today he did. And I'm guessing he stated that because they've been getting feedback. to the contrary. I have not really been going out to bars and restaurants all that much, but from what I've seen and the feedback I've gotten from people, both staff and customers, is that like any other business, for any other, there's so many things you need to do to operate a business, particularly when it comes to food. Some people are going to be, you know, adhere to the rules a little bit better than others. And some people are on purpose going to like push the edge. And that's the case now. Some people are whatever. Other people are going to be a lot more strict. But then you also have the issue of, okay, so what if I'm going to do everything right? And then I get some guy like Big Koa, 6'5", 300 pounds, who comes to the door and says, I'm not going to wear a mask. And you got some little guy like me at the door as the manager saying, oh, can't you let you in here without a mask? And Big Koa just walks right by me. Now what's your recourse then? What are you going to do, right? And you've seen these viral videos of these people on the mainland, you know, the people losing it. And, you know, people getting spit on and people getting pushed. And so you as a venue can do everything right. But also you can pay lip service to doing everything right and then just let people do whatever.
That's correct.
And from what I understand, there's been a little of both. And, you know, people complain that, you know, if you don't want things to go, you know, the cases to go back up, if you want to get to a point where we can reopen and have things go back to normal, that's a one step back, two steps forward situation. I mean, I can't think of a better analogy than that. It's like, let's lock it down for a little bit so that we can be open forever instead of locking it down for not quite enough. To reopen, to lock it back down, to reopen, to lock it back down, because you've decided like somehow you're taking away my freedoms or whatever. Nobody bitches about seatbelts. You know, if I feel like if there wasn't seatbelts on cars and tomorrow someone said you got to wear a seatbelt to wear a car, half the country would lose their shit and say, how dare you ask me to wear a seatbelt in a car? How dare you ask me to wear a helmet on a motorcycle? How dare you ask me to put on a seatbelt on an airplane? It's like people have lost their marbles and lost their common sense. Yeah. And, you know, it's like most of this stuff isn't about you. It's about protecting my 99-year-old grandpa.
Exactly.
It's not about you catching the disease. It's about you being the HPV silent STD carrier, giving it to the girl where you didn't even know.
I like that one.
Yes. Yes.
Exactly right. And that's the thing. We're slowly seeing it happen in Hawaii, where we're slowly seeing the little bit more Karens than we thought we had. I've been seeing a lot of people but not wearing their masks. A lot of young people partying at a house, partying at somebody's house for some party just to go hang out because they miss each other.
I've seen it at businesses, and I've seen it posted on social media.
Yeah.
You know, social media is going to be the great equalizer for all this, because if you are someone who's paying attention and you're in a position to enforce things, and whether it's arresting people or giving people fines or pulling their liquor license, I would just get a bunch of interns and be like, you guys are just going to sit on TikTok, Snapchat, and Instagram all day long.
Exactly.
What I think is going to happen is we could do everything right. Even if the last 2 weeks the trend was just flat or going down or whatever, the minute we open, if there's 40 out of 50 states are having their worst, you know, their worst number of cases ever, if you let those states start flying in here and you don't have proper protocols in place, because you want people to travel here, you know, the number one state to come here is California, and they're not having a good go of it right now. Right.
Yeah.
Washington has had issues. Arizona's having issues. Obviously, all the West Coast states that are the closest, we get a ton of business from them. We do, you know, we get Hawaii is going to be just like post 9/11, which, by the way, 9/11 was on a Pussycat Lounge night and I was open that night. We can talk about that's a whole story, but
that's in your top five, maybe. Okay.
What's going to happen is people that want to travel and have the means and decide that it's okay, instead of going to Europe, which won't even allow us to go there, or going on some exotic locale, the most exotic place you can go and still be in the United States. And oh, by the way, their numbers are the lowest. It's the safest place to be.
That's all good.
They're going to come here. And all these people are going to fly in and get the rest of us infected. And then they're going to get on a plane and get the staff, you know, the flight attendants infected, and get the baggage handlers infected, and get the ticketing people infected. And just so that, and then they're going to go to Waikiki, and they're all on top of each other in Waikiki. That's why New York has such issues, is because it's such a dense, you know, people are so densely packed in together. And so it's sort of, I would say things are not looking good, is what I would say.
You think? Yeah.
But you know what? I get it. If I own a bar or a restaurant or whatever, pick the business that relies on, you know, people coming in, if it's one of these high risk businesses, if I owned a gym or whatever, how long can I afford to stay closed before I just say, listen, live or die? Like, I don't want to be homeless.
Right.
I have a family to feed. I've got employees to feed. I need to open, and we'll just do the best that we can.
That's all you can do at this point. The virus ain't going away. We don't have a cure. We don't even have a treatment that's adequate. We just have to let nature take its course at this point. And we just got to be responsible.
Correct.
And use logic and use common sense here. And I stated in the beginning before you joined, I think a lot of it has to do with these house parties.
Yeah, I thought I was joining the wrong podcast. You were going on a Rona rant, and I'm like, maybe I'm on next week.
where are we at here? I know, But then I did a nice intro of you, so then you're here.
Very embarrassing.
Well, I gotta say, because Instagram's gonna kick us off because we got that hour time limit.
I know, isn't that annoying?
I hate it. So let's go. Give me your top three. I gave you an assignment: most memorable wave moments that you were not blacked out at.
I met after a Metallica played the arena in whatever late 90s, whatever. And we were the official Metallica after party. And Lars, the drummer for Metallica, actually showed up. He sat upstairs at the upstairs bar with Ivan by himself. I'm like the hugest Metallica fan ever. I went to the show, and I come after the show, and I'm like, oh, my God. There's Lars sitting by himself at the bar. So I sat down and I chatted him up a little bit. I didn't want to like take up his time and be like super weird, but I was like, and I'm a drummer and like the whole thing. I was just, I could not believe that, that Lars came to the official after party.
Right.
Very cool. There's so many more. Diplo played for us when he was just a mashup DJ.
Yeah.
And he had who's this cute little Indian girl with him in the DJ booth? Turns out it didn't dawn on us till a couple years later. That was MIA. So Diplo is in the DJ booth playing. He used to be the best mashup DJ, by the way. Not like Z-Trip. Z-Trip would do more sort of mainstream mashup stuff, where Diplo was more on the underground mashup shit. Right. And he had this the little Indian girl with him in the DJ. But KSM was the one that told me, he's like, dude, you remember that thing a couple years ago? That turned out to be MIA. And then there was a time when MIA was actually way bigger than Diplo was. So that was one I got to meet. Vinny Appice, the drummer for Black Sabbath, was in this sort of old school metal cover band, and it was like the guitar player for Quiet Riot. Like every guy was a guy in a big band, only they weren't like the main guys, right? But to meet the drummer for Black Sabbath, and they did two or three nights with us, and I legitimately like was hanging out with them every night. And again, as a drummer, and I was just like, dude, Black Sabbath, and it was just so cool to meet him. And you know, most of the people I dealt with were super cool. I have a fun. I don't know how much time we have left, but I have a very
A minute left. I know. Shit.
We did the was it the ITF? We did an ITF event. G-Spot did. And A-Track comes in. He's 16 years old. He has the very first beta version of Serato that anyone has seen. And the entire place was a room full of DJs that were completely losing it, not because of his set, but they were like, this kid is playing on a computer with no records.
Amazing.
And that turned out to be Serato.
I got to say this, we got 30 seconds. I am a big fan of Iron DJ. Now you go tell Compose to get off. Well, we can't do anything now. But I always shout out Iron DJ. I enjoyed it. I went every week. It was a very fun time. It was great to see an event like that with all the DJs coming together playing like these games and whatnot. So thank you, sir. I was a big fan. I love it. We got 7 seconds remaining. Flash, I love you.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. Happy to come back anytime.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Time's Over. Time's over. No sleeping tonight.